So I have some of my old data. It's interesting to present old data, kind of review and have new reflections on some old stuff. But I also have collected a little bit of new stuff. But first of all, I wanted to dedicate this presentation to our lost colleague, John Studeman, who passed away this summer. And I know several of you know him, and it was a loss to all of us. Integrated systems, I just want to give some examples of that. I mean, there are many different types of integrated systems. You may find a system that you work with here. Certainly, we need more integrated systems. We know the ramifications of specialization and how that can cause issues. Certainly, they have caused us a lot of economic gain. But, you know, the pressures are really dramatic to make sure that those margins, those small margins, are met. And so we have a lot of issues to identify. The integrated crop livestock systems is certainly an area where we could gain more from having cattle and crops together. We also have this potential, at least in the southeastern U.S. and perhaps other places, of an agroforestry or a silvopasture system. We have extreme heat in the summertime, and trees provide shade. There's a dramatic benefit to the animals that can occur. We also have this, and this would be the silvopasture system. Of course, on the second one I gave you was agroforestry. We tried that. We had failure because the crops aren't necessarily suited to certain soil types. And actually, I'm not going to present any of that information that we do have on agroforestry or silvopasture, but we do have a silvopasture experiment now that transitioned from cropping because of the crop failures that occurred on these marginal soils or marginal croplands. And then there is also this possibility of actually integrating all three aspects of the trees, the grass, and the crops. And I had the good fortune of attending the first World Congress on Integrated Crop Livestock Forestry Systems. And I'm encouraged that I think that the Brazilian colleagues, they probably will continue investigating that. I wanted to bring your attention first to a series of studies that we've conducted on farms. This is an example from the Frank Lee Farm. After the study that I'm going to present to you next is, and the results that have been obtained over a number of years, I've been interested in this. How do we get more adoption? Finding farmers that actually do this in practice that are not needing encouragement. Frank Lee has not needed this encouragement. He's a cattle producer. He's a grain producer. He's a cotton producer. He has an integrated system, and the soils that he has are rough. They're in Stanley County, North Carolina. Hugh Hammond Bennett was from Stanley County or nearby, and these soils are tough to farm when they are tilled. But Frank Lee has been no-tilling, and he does graze his cover crops. This is a cover crop. It's actually a mixture of species. There he had hairy vetch, clover, and rye in there. And this is after the grazing, so I just wanted to show you that he leaves a lot of stubble behind, and that's a good thing. These are some of the soils that we had here from this sampling there. So the zone here from the left to the middle there, the third of that is 4 inches, and then the 4 to 8 is in the middle, and then 8 to 12 would be below that. So the soil is red, and but you also see, I wanted to bring your attention, this is a probe that's now laying on its side, but it of course goes down, and these cracks that occur in the soil are permanent. There are essentially faces of soil in that 4 to 8 inch zone that are permanent. Water moves through this soil very readily, despite it has not been tilled, it has cattle on it. And so I think this is an important aspect of a long-term no-till system, building organic matter, building roots. These roots are exploring areas. These are cover crop roots because this was a sampling immediately after this condition right here. These roots, I wanted to show you that the soil was taken actually below 30 centimeters, so I needed the soil above 30 centimeters for my soil collection, but this happened to be below 30 centimeters, and so that's why you see that the week 30 on the lower left. But that root there, that root from a cover crop, is following a root channel that was there before. And I point that out to you because the channel itself is much wider than the root that's there. But these roots follow the old channels. And so a continuous no-till system with grazing can provide good benefit. It can certainly create a better water cycling and, I believe, a nutrient cycling as well. Because the roots themselves, they do not have to explore all of the soil. They just have to access the nutrients that they're after. So this site here, we are looking at it for the biological activity. So I give you a number here. I don't know that anybody knows what that number would mean, but this means to me that it's a fairly good soil. In the top 4 inches of soil, we have a value of 370 milligrams of CO2 per kilogram per 3 days. And this is soil that's been dried and re-wetted. And that would translate into roughly about 74 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per season. And so there's a significant amount of nitrogen that could be mineralized. And I bring that up to your attention because we actually conducted a nitrogen trial on this site. And we've done it on multiple sites, and essentially nitrogen fertilizer did nothing to the yield. There was no response. This is in Stanley County. The current recommendation is that you need to apply 1 pound of nitrogen per bushel of gain of production that you want. So in this case, there's essentially a lot of nutrient cycling. This is an anecdote that has been observed, but it's been observed on other farms as well. And unfortunately, I don't have that published yet. But I'm going to move you to the longer term study that we have conducted in Georgia when I was in North Georgia. And I just bring it your attention that in the winter it's not necessarily freezing, but it's you know, the temperature is a limiting factor in the wintertime, and the dryness is potentially a limiting factor in the summertime. So we have potential for production, but we have limitations as well. Okay, the study was tillage by cover crop utilization by cropping system. And so we had conventional till and no-till. We had cover crops that were either grazed or not. And Dennis knows about that land area very well. And the cropping system was either a winter cropping season or summer cropping. So this shows you the utilization of our cover crops, and we intentionally use the cover crop excessively. I'm not sure that that's the right recommendation that should be made. We should maybe balance that a little bit more. We could see the bare ground, you know, we could see the ground itself. I'm not sure we should really be able to see the ground after grazing. But we utilize it very effectively, but I'll point out that it was something that actually gave us some economic gain in the short term. So as far as the crop production, we had an actual depression in the grain yield of sorghum, and in 1 year, this was 4 years, and then 1 year we had corn, and 3 years we had sorghum. We did not have high yields because we had significant drought conditions during the summer. But it did show that where we grazed, we had lower yield. We had lower yield of the stover as well, but we did see that the no-tillage, being a conservation approach, did lead to higher yield than the conventional tillage. So we had greater water storage with that no-tillage. And then with the rye cover crop, obviously at the end of the growing season, we had much greater rye cover crop biomass, let's just say, in the ungrazed situation versus the grazed situation. But it did show that we, under no-tillage, we were able to produce more. Again, the water utilization by a no-till situation and the nutrient cycling associated with that was very important. For the winter season, we saw no difference in the grain yield over three seasons. But we did see a difference, and actually this was a reverse effect. In the gray situation, we had greater wheat stover that was left behind. And the pearl millet, there was this difference between the residual forage mass, but again, the no-tillage producing more biomass than the conventional tillage. We didn't have to, but we changed the design midstream. We kept the tillage effect, we kept the cover crop utilization, but we changed the cropping system. And in this case here, we had actually greater, this depression in yield with the graze situation. And consistently, we had this greater no-tillage versus conventional tillage. So the combination of a no-tillage and a graze may not be necessarily so bad, but we could get better with just an ungrazed situation in this case. But again, I bring your attention that we used that cover crop very fully, and it probably had a negative impact on some water storage. With soybean, the same situation really occurred. And with wheat, again, for whatever reason, the winter crop did not respond the same way. And then in the third phase was that we actually converted some of our conventional till land to no-tillage. And that would be more like a conversion of that a farmer adopts. And that's so I did fail to tell you that this study was following 20 years of tall fescue pasture. We had a buildup of organic matter at the surface, and that was an important aspect. And so this short-term no-tillage in the middle there is the next stage here, where a producer would come into a somewhat denuded situation. We have bare ground, And what we saw was that, again, variation was large, but we see this depression with the grazed situation versus the ungrazed. And I think the important part was this progression of the yield potential that occurred, is that with conventional tillage, the short-term no-tillage, and then the long-term no-tillage, we were increasing the yield along that gradient. And so that preservation of soil with long-term no-tillage is really important, similar with the wheat biomass. So to summarize some of the crop effects, I'm not done. I want to get through this quickly, but we did have some inhibition of the summer grain crops with grazing of the winter crop. The no-tillage cover crops were better producing than the conventional till cover crops, and that the long-term no-tillage was better than the short-term no-tillage. We had animal gains in this study, of course. John Studeman was an integral part of this. We had generally about a month to 2 months of grazing that occurred each year. And we saw that the yield, the animal gains were relatively good on average. We had 200 to 250 kilograms per hectare with the spring grazing. And then in the summer, we had a little bit higher levels. We had 238 to 291. And you see that we did not continue the summer grazing in the latter years. But it shows that we got a significant animal gain, and that with that animal gain, there's a value associated with that, economic gain, that actually that's what the producer is going to want to see, so that the transition to a grazed cover crop can occur, because you can actually increase this. Now, that opportunity has to be present on the farm, as was mentioned. And it also showed that the summer cover crop was a little bit more productive. It led to greater number of grazing days than the winter crop. But it did show also that the no-tillage was actually a better system than for animal gain. So that increase in forage availability led to increase in animal gain. I wanted to bring your attention to the soil aspects now. And that the bulk density was low at the surface and increased with depth because, again, it was 20 years of no-till of pasture before that. Oftentimes we think of pastures and compaction, and it can occur, certainly, but with that buildup of organic matter with the long-term pasture, we have this incorporation of organic matter and this lowering of bulk density. We saw no difference between grazed and ungrazed when we had conventional tillage, and with no-tillage there was essentially no difference there either. But when we transitioned from a conventional tillage to a no-tillage, there was that significant difference that occurred at the surface, and there was that effect right there, and it actually perpetuated lower into the profile as well. And so there are some significant challenges in the conversion process or the transition process from a conventional tillage to a no-till system, and that has to be overcome. So grazing of a cover crop maybe in the early transition may not be the best practice to use. So the starting point with high organic matter with no tillages, I think, is an important part. As far as the compaction that occurred during the grazing period that we measured during these four dry events, that's what's indicated there on the top, in years 3 and 4, and essentially there was no difference with the grazing or ungrazed situation. In the surface, the effect was due to tillage. We had higher during dry events. It's harder to get a probe in the ground. That's often what we measure in a perennial pasture. It's drier and it's harder to get the probe in the ground, and that occurs with moisture. So water is very important. We have that effect there. When we looked at the wet events, there were some effects that occurred. Here, the dry conditions you see at the top there, and then the wet conditions. So we had different conditions. We had greater water storage with the no-tillage. Here we saw that actually the grazing did induce some compaction, and it was significant. And then with depth, it was more due to the no-tillage than anything else. Similar, it occurred for water infiltration. So I bring your attention to the infiltration rate on the right side, is that we had significant less water infiltration with a grazed situation than an ungrazed situation. And this happened to be during the wet soil conditions, again, the water filling up the pores, and so there's less opportunity for that water to drain. We also looked at nitrogen mineralization, and I know these are a lot of numbers here, but the point being that with conventional tillage, we had relatively uniform distribution with depth. Whereas with no-tillage, we had a really strong stratification of nitrogen mineralization with depth. We had very high nitrogen mineralization at the surface and very low nitrogen mineralization with depth. So in our conditions, that's just the reality. That's what we get in the Southeast. We have this little opportunity to create this greater condition with depth. Now, so that means that maybe sometimes periodic tillage might provide some advantage, but I think it has to be really periodic, and it has to be that we have to cover the soil. So in this case here, the nitrogen mineralization did not really change whether it was due to tillage, and it did not change whether it was grazed or ungrazed. So that meant that the condition that we started with was preserved under both of those situations, that tillage and grazing did not necessarily affect the soil properties. So in summary, cover crops certainly provide high quality forage and increase economic return and farm diversity. But in essence, farmers haven't really taken that advantage. They've been advised that, you know, it probably causes compaction, and it can cause compaction. We have to be careful, and that's why we need more investigation of this. But compaction is often misinterpreted as dryness of the soil. Rotation of crops following long-term pasture was highly effective in limiting that compaction, and that's an opportunity for us. We have some significant forage lands in the southeastern U.S., and rotating them is one of our great advantages that we should take. We should take that advantage. And so it's not only for water, but it's also for nitrogen and phosphorus and nutrient cycling itself. And we should really look into that a little deeper. So grazing of cover crops did compact the soil, and it was relatively small. The bulk density occurred more due to the switching from conventional to no-tillage. And grazing, I didn't show any of the data on organic carbon, but we saw no difference whether it was grazed or ungrazed. So the grazing didn't enhance it. The grazing didn't decrease organic carbon either, and that was over a 7-year period. But grazing did increase penetration resistance, and that could be a concern. But again, as I pointed out in the pictures early in the study, it's actually important that we just have these fissures in the soil rather than the density itself. Bulk density may not be the best measure for us. But in essence, the ring infiltrometer did show that there were some limitations. So just to conclude, the integrated systems are productive. It can be developed for the warm, moist southeastern U.S. No-tillage is an important aspect of that. If we don't have a conservation approach with our tillage system, I don't think we can get the great environmental benefits. And we need to be strategic in how we stock those lands. And so it cannot necessarily be in a very wet period. Unfortunately, in our situation, we did have animals out there during wet periods. And that may be the reality for a lot of producers, but they have to be aware of that and maybe create some situations where they can avoid that. And certainly starting from that high organic matter position is very important. So that's what I'm going to leave you with, and so thanks for your attention. Okay, thanks, Ben. The question was, what would it take for growers to get perennial pastures into the crop rotation? Well, I think the situation would be that if a producer has animals, they are the ones that to target at least initially, because they often, those that have pasture or have animals, they also have some crops. They not all the time, but they oftentimes they do. At least dairy producers would, because they're often growing corn silage or other silage sources. So that's probably a target audience to start with. Getting row crop producers in the coastal plain region to adopt perennial pastures, I think, is a huge challenge. There's no doubt about it, because they've abandoned that practice long ago, and no one has any information for them. So I think maybe Dennis, you can steer me correctly, but I think it's a big challenge.
I agree with you. I think the biggest advantage of doing it in the coastal plain for us in Georgia at least is we have irrigation there, which mitigates a lot of the problems that you're talking about. Of course, a lot of that's going to be tilled around anyway, because it's peanuts and you're right. And there is a lot of folks that are interested in it, but it's going to take some... I think what you're really going to look for is a row crop producer who is contracting with a beef cattle producer and doing a yardage fee or a head fee to run cattle on that land. You're not going to have row crop producers, I don't think, many anyway, that are running cattle and row crop.
Right. Good. Thanks for that comment. I would say that, you know, there is that opportunity just to graze the cover crops. So it's an annual crop. That gives producers an opportunity to experience that. And whether they even have the animals, that's going to be tough, but they can contract that on their land. And the perennial part is a little bit more difficult, but that's maybe down the line somewhat. Dwayne?
Can you speculate on how much cover rent is needed?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't really have that data, but I know that my colleague Paulo Carvalho in Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil, he's got data on a long-term study, and it would suggest that I think the forage mass is actually somewhat variable, but the indication would be that 20 centimeters of height left would be the target to get the most benefit. Now, of course, if you graze to 10 centimeters, 4 inches, you're going to maybe get a little bit more animal gain, but it's at the expense of a lot of other things. So I think the target height would be about 8 inches based on his study. Yeah. Jose? We did measure that, and we saw no difference. I mean, we only measured nitrate concentration to 90 centimeters. So it's conceivable that there was some loss during the periods when we didn't measure. But we measured maybe every 2 years or so. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. More root mass, more biomass production, more translocation of nutrients. So it was quite a lot of benefit. And getting a look on that, many of the comments today and many of the talks today were talking about grazing or no grazing, but that doesn't mean much. Grazing management is key for the establishment and the success of the system. So we should be looking into grazing, the proper grazing those cover crops.
Thank you for that comment. I think that's a challenge to all of us. As, you know, I don't think you should take our example as the one to look for, because I think we graze too closely. I think it'd be better if we actually have a residual forage mass that leads to better environmental condition. Thanks so much.